Good morning. Can you hear me okay? Great. No? Thank you for the bell reminder from Anna. That was good. I forgot about that. I'm Katie Kingery-Page. I'll be your convener this morning. Before we begin, I'd like to ask all of you to turn your attention to the announcements in the order of service. I'd also like to mention that the most recent newsletter is now available. I believe it's the July newsletter, actually, already. Is that right, Michael? And it is available out in the lobby commons area for after the service. I'd like to make an announcement that the next meeting of the UUFM Social Action Committee is this Wednesday, July 2nd at 7 p.m. All are welcome. And let me ask Ann Cowan, is that here at the Fellowship? So here at the Fellowship, this Wednesday, July 2nd at 7 p.m., that's the meeting of the UUFM Social Action Committee. I believe Michael Oldfather has an announcement as well.
After 2 years of debate and discussion, a decision has come out of that process, and it involved the minister, the pianists, the music committee, and the program committee. It's too late for anyone else to weigh in. The decision has been made. Beginning this morning, following the offertory, we are not asking for applause. In fact, just the contrary. It's the time of this the service when we kind of settle in and anyway, a lot of people had an opinion. And we thank all of you for your opinions.
So in case you were confused, I believe that decision was no applause after musical performances, and I can appreciate that because there's many times when
the offertory,
so that we can just dwell in that meditative space after the music. Well, good morning, and welcome to all who are just now sitting down. Please let me know if you can't hear me at any time, because I tend to have a dwindling voice that gets softer as I go along, so let me know if I need to speak it up. This morning, we'll examine issues of social justice and civil rights for the blind. As may be said of many injustices, the issues facing blind Kansans can in some ways be attributed to a very deep misunderstanding, the misunderstanding of what people who happen to be blind are capable of. To quote the National Federation of the Blind spokesman, Chris Danielson, "Blind people can do virtually anything. The misconception is that if you don't have sight, simply, you don't have the capacity. What people fail to think about is that blind people develop alternate ways of doing things." Lauren Eckery, a blind woman from Nebraska, wrote an essay titled, "What Color is the Sun?" to share her experience of bravely crossing the divide between her daughter's sighted experience of the world and her experience of the world. The following passage is from Ms. Eckery's essay. "Several weeks ago, my 8-year-old daughter, Lyndon, asked, 'Mommy, what color is the sun?' She blinks and often sneezes upon looking directly at the sun. Was it possible that she never looked long enough to notice the color of the sun? Was she testing me to see if I knew the color of the sun? What answer did she expect to get from me? The standard yellow? I am totally blind since birth due to congenital glaucoma. I have no vision in the left eye. Before glaucoma took my right eye, I could see light, dark, and blobs of color. I cried the evening before the surgery, panicked a few times immediately thereafter, and that was it. I was not bitter about never seeing another sunset, because I knew that in my mind's eye, I could conjure one up easily enough if I wanted to do so. Perhaps this is similar to the manner in which Beethoven was able to write some of his best music when he could no longer hear. He had a good mind, and he used it. I told Lyndon that in the middle of the day, the sun is said to be yellow, although it always looked white to me. I explained that towards sunset, the color could change from a brighter yellow, becoming more and more orange, sometimes setting in a brilliant red-orange ball with other colors around it. Clouds, I surmised. When this occurs, the bright fiery ball on the horizon looks as though it's resting on the ground quite far away. Eventually it disappears. Sometimes the clouds hide this color. Often the sun does just the opposite at sunrise. Sunrises and sunsets can vary. Artists have painted them. Writers have described them in words. Some people do not notice them at all, but there they are. I've never seen the sun change color like that. Why does it change color? Why does it look like the sun is on the ground? My daughter asked curiously. Her questions were getting beyond me. I didn't know enough about the physical properties of light, color, refraction, and distance, plus the rotation of the earth, etc., to explain it all to her. Anxiously, I said, "Ask your science teacher when school starts again." With a sigh of relief, I presumed the subject closed, only to hear, "Mommy, could you see rays coming out of the sun?" I told her I couldn't. "Me neither," she replied. "Then why do people make pictures of the sun with rays coming out all around it?" she continued. I thought, "Ask your art teacher when school starts again." However, being somewhat more artistic than scientific, I explained that maybe it was an artistic way to show that light and heat were coming from all directions, from the yellow circle which represented the sun in pictures. That was the end of the discussion for the time being. I believed that Lyndon, and this again is the words of Lauren Eckery, I believed that Lyndon was surprised by the answer she got from a totally blind person. I was equally astonished that a sighted child would bother to ask a totally blind person to describe something visual, taking the answer seriously. I believe we both learned something extremely valuable from this experience. The knowledge gained and the joy received from this experience were made evident this past weekend as we were riding the bus home from Kansas City to Omaha. Lyndon had been sleeping, and I was listening to my tape recorder. Suddenly, she shouted with obvious delight, "Mommy, the sun is orange, and it's on the ground, just like you said." It looked like it was on the ground. "It's red-orange, and it's pretty. I've never seen that before." I was aware that if I'd believed all of the stereotypes about blindness, that I would never have done such a normal thing as to get married and have a child, one I was now sharing a sunset with, because I might have believed that a blind person couldn't take care of a child independently. I was thankful for this National Federation of the Blind influenced blessing. I was also aware at that moment that this sunset might have gone unnoticed by both of us had we not had our previous discussion. Certainly, it would not have been a life or death disaster if we had missed the sunset, but there was a particular joy in our sharing, "What color is the sun?" Our guest speaker and program leader today is my brother, Tom Page, president of the National Federation of the Blind of Kansas. Tom's educational background is in cognitive psychology and statistical research methods, but he chooses to make his career in music as a performer, a songwriter, and an audio engineer who owns and runs his own studio. Tom, would you please join me at the podium to light the chalice?
The chalice is our Unitarian symbol of hope and comfort, and I know that Tom would like to share a few words with us after he lights it.
Yes, perfect.
I appreciate that "What color is the sun?" passage, and I'm glad that Katie chose that to talk about this morning. And people say, well, you know, what color perhaps is the flame in this chalice? And you know, it's the color of warmth. I like that. It's the color of energy. So thank you for all being here this morning to share your warmth and energy. And we'll talk a little more about civil rights for the blind, ? In just a moment. And I guess it's time to move right into singing of the first song. Is that correct, Katie? Okay, great. This is where I feel more comfortable, not in the speaking role. So move over here and get behind my protective microphone stand. Hello, hello. All right. Sounds like it's pretty hot, Mike. I've been liking to sing this song just recently, and it's kind of come back to me. And so that's what I chose to do today. We'll send it out in memory of its author, the late, great Kate Wolfe here.
I've been walking in my sleep, counting trouble, instead of counting sheep. Where the years went, I can't say. I just turned around and they gone away. I've been sifting through the layers of dusty books and faded papers tell a story I used to know, but it happened so long ago. It's gone away yesterday. Now I find myself on the mountainside, where the rivers change direction across a great divide. Now I heard the owl calling softly as the night was falling, with a question, and I replied, but he's gone across the borderline. It's gone away yesterday. Now I find myself on the mountainside, where the rivers change direction across the great divide. Finest hour I have seen is the one that comes between the edge of night and the break of day. It's when the darkness rolls away. It's gone away yesterday. Now I find myself on the mountainside, where the rivers change direction across a great divide. It's gone away yesterday. Now I find myself on the mountainside, where the rivers change direction across the great divide.
I think that, thank you. Oh, the morning is easier with music. And I think that, why that song came to mind is that it is full of the symbolism of realization, the symbolism of darkness to light, of ignorance to knowledge.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, thank you.
And we all took the chance to clap. It's great. Took the risk. Now I would like to welcome all of you to share any expression of joy or concern, to share with the rest of us anything that may be on your heart or on your mind. And if you would like to share something, please raise your hand, and William will bring the microphone.
Hi, my name is Sonia. And when you got up there to the speakerphone, I felt that immediately into my heart, because I have Usher syndrome, and I'm going blind and deaf. And there's something I would like to share with you. I never, in my whole life, meeting those blind people, I felt this in my heart. They have so much joy. They're so happy. They feel so loved. And when I went to the Braille Institute in North Hollywood in California, okay, this lady gave me a tour. She is totally blind. She speaks five different languages, and she's beautiful. okay, and she was using a cane. She'd been working there for almost like 10 years. I mean, I had a hard time catching up with her. I was following her with a cane, and she just showed me the restroom, showed me the art class, showed me the cooking class, you know. And then she took me to the last place, and I saw this beautiful palm tree and a water fountain. You can hear the birds, and I can see on the wall what's drawn on there, but there's a bunch of little stones. But she doesn't know what it looks like, but she can put her hands on the wall, and she knows what it says. She's like, Sonia, I need you to hold this cane for me. So I did. And she puts her hands on the wall, and she said, you see this? She says, in the beginning. And she said, and you see this cloud? She said, this is where you at. You got the bad news from the doctor. You don't know which direction to go, and you're scared. And she moved to the next wall, okay, and you see a dove flying through the cloud. She said, you're going to get all the help you can get all the resources, and you'll be on the right path. And then at last, and you see a bunch of birds with the rainbows, and says, and you'll finally see the light. And I immediately cried. It was so beautiful. And it's hard for me, and I'm praying every day that hopefully I will be able to see my son grow up and see him in graduation, see him in wedding, and hopefully in praying and meditate not to lose all my vision, because there's no cure for that. And one out of 150,000 gets it, and I'm one of them. So, and I said, I want to say thank you for sharing. And I felt that in my heart. Thank you.
And we're glad you're here.
Hi, Aaron Ford. Just, it's a pleasure to be back, always in Kansas. It's short but sweet this year. So glad you all are still here doing your thing. It's beautiful to see.
Gene Severs. Dixie Moreau fell last week. She had her puppy in her arms, and so trying to keep from hurting the puppy, she landed on her right elbow and shattered it. And she's having surgery, outpatient surgery, to put it back together tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Bobette McGoy, and we've had a big week in our family. Our daughter was here from California, and we have celebrated and are celebrating Nick's 10th birthday tomorrow.
I have a concern. Last week, after I spoke about my atheism, Annelle Forrester came up to me and said, I didn't hear a word you said. So I want to call attention to probably at least 10% of our congregation that has difficulty hearing. And I would like to see us put some kind of a system in whereby the speaker always reminds, or the convener always reminds the speaker to hold the microphone up and speak clearly, and for some kind of feedback if you're not being able to get here or whatever. And I also have something else to share. I have a live trap. I was trying to catch a rat that's living under my shed. Instead, I caught a little black and white kitten. And if anyone is interested, I'm planning to take it to the shelter. Well, Deanna told me, well, tell them it's a Unitarian cat. And I can't, because it's black and white.
Okay. I'd like to welcome our pastor, Reverend Michael Nelson, up to the front of the sanctuary for the story of all ages. And all of the children, too. Please, come.
Come on up. We're going to sit over by Tom today, a different place. Katie, can I sit by Tom? No, that's perfect. In the mic, I got it. Hello, everyone. Wait a minute. Now, there we are. I can see everyone. Can everyone hear me if I do this? Great. Well, I want you to pretend that I am Grandpa Sam, okay?
And then I have my granddaughter, Marina, who's about 4 or 5, and she still fits very comfortably in my lap. Okay? So I'm going to play Marina, and I'm also going to play Grandpa Sam. Marina. Grandpa, how did you know that Grandma was beautiful? Well, honey, this is Grandpa Sam, I could hear it in her voice. I could smell it when I walked by her or she was close to me. There was something about her fragrance that made me feel so alive and happy. And when I touched her cheek, I just loved the way it felt. But how did you know she was beautiful? You can't see. She goes, you don't, he said, you don't need to see, honey, to know someone's beautiful. You can feel it. It was, you know what Grandma said, Grandpa Sam? She said, I'm the luckiest person in the world to have met your grandpa. And Grandpa Sam said to Marina, I am the luckiest man in the world to have met your grandma. So we both feel lucky. Well, how did you meet Grandpa? Well, we were at college. I was at the University of Michigan, and she was a student, and she was studying psychology, and we ran into each other literally in the library. My stick was in the wrong place, and I hit her in the head. And that's how we met, head to head. And we started to talk. I said, I was very sorry. She said, no problem. And that's how it began. We just met by accident in a library. How did you know you loved her, though? I mean, if you can't see her, how can you know that you love somebody? Isn't loving somebody because you see them and you get all excited? Sam goes, for a lot of people, that is the way they know. But you know, you have hearing, you have smell, you have taste, and you have touch. And you have this overall sense of knowing somebody. And you know when you're in love because everything inside you becomes alive and quicker. And it doesn't take your eyes to know that. Well, Grandpa, can you see in your dreams? Well, this is not easy because I don't see what you probably see, but I see what I think are colors. I feel textures. So I have a sense of what the ocean is because I feel the ocean in my dreams. I feel the sky. Sometimes I think I am flying in the air like a big bird soaring on the wind. And sometimes I feel like a little kitten licking your face. Do you know how that feels when a kitten licks your face with that soft, raspy tongue? Do you know what that feels like? So, Grandpa, do you wish you could see? Well, honey, of course. I wish like everyone who has lost an ability, someone who can't walk, someone who can't use their hands, someone who can't hear, someone who can't taste. Every person who loses that wishes that they had all of their senses. But let me tell you something. When you're blind, you learn how to hear very well. You can hear in the distant the wind coming. You can hear your loved one coming through the door, opening the door, all those things. And you, when you taste everything. Your whole body tastes that wonderful crisp apple. So, of course, I would like to see. But, Grandpa, you can't see me. Oh, honey, you are here on my lap. You are as dear to me as anything could be. But wouldn't you like to see me? Sure, I would like to be able to see you because I know you're beautiful. And I know that you're just a gorgeous little girl. Everything in me tells me that's so. She goes, but I'm not. I got freckles. Oh, freckles. Wonderful. That's wonderful. Freckles are beautiful. And Grandpa, are you lying to me? No, honey. No. I'm going to tell you something. And I want you to remember this. This is really, really important. The heart. You know where the heart is. Does everyone here know where the heart is, right? Right here, right here. The heart knows things that the mind will never understand. And if you go into life with that knowledge that the heart will lead you to good places, if you follow it, using your mind is a great thing, but your heart knows things that the mind can never understand. And that's a good thing. And my heart knows you as a very wonderful, wonderful granddaughter. Okay, Grandpa, I guess you've answered my questions. So thanks a lot, guys. You guys have a good class, all right?
But
thank you for having me here. Really appreciate the warmth, and I'm beginning to understand after Reverend Michael's talk with the children that I'm in a very knowledgeable group already. So maybe we'll skip over some of my talking here, but also thank you for the lovely piano. So let's see here, where to begin? In the beginning, there was only darkness. The earth was without form, and there was only void. And perhaps we won't go that far back, because that's going to take a while to move forward. But throughout human history, blindness has been a part of the human experience. Some of the earliest blind people that we know about through historical record are Homer, the Greek poet who is credited with writing of the Iliad. Milton, later writer, also has left us with his words in the fantastic Paradise Lost. A little louder. Okay. Excuse me. Let me get a little closer. Maybe that'll work better. Is that a little better? Okay. Okay, great. So the part that was inaudible really was a joke, and then a brief introduction that blindness is a fact of life, if you will. We're a very small part of the population, but since the beginning of human history, there have been blind people out there figuring out how to get by. Over the years, what are termed best practices have changed very dramatically. For most of human history, the best practice, if you were a mother of a blind child, was to leave that child on the hillside to die. I'm glad that I wasn't born during that period. In the early 1500s, the dawn of the Renaissance and the beginning of the move towards enlightenment, blind people began organizing into special guilds, and those guilds produced various sorts of material goods, and that allowed blind people for the first time to achieve independence and both personally and financially. Not a lot is known about those groups, but we do know that weaving and other sorts of arts were produced by these blind guilds. Moving forward again in history, of course, as we know, in the late 1700s, our country, the United States, was born. The constitutional protections and freedoms that were written into our democracy produced an environment in which people not only were allowed, for in many cases the first time, to self-associate and self-organize, but actually encouraged. Now that takes us a little closer to the present. In my own story, I'm a product of post-industrial late 20th century America. In 1972, my parents found they had given birth to a legally blind child, but didn't really know what that meant and weren't really sure what to do. And their decision was to raise me as a child. I think that was a pretty good one. Pretty good one all the way around. Now, many of these things are, like anything, every thorn has its rose, so to speak. Legal blindness actually means less than 10% of normal vision. So when I was a youth, I could read up close. I got by. I had glasses. As far as I knew, most of the things that might be attributable to blindness, I attributed to being different. I came from a family that valued reading very highly. That was different. Came from a family that was interested in social justice. That was different. Came from a family that was interested in organizing other people in social justice missions. That was different. So we had many messages telling us to be quiet and keep it to ourselves. As in Kansas, many of these ideas were so different that they could cause you trouble at the Sunday school you were visiting or at the Catholic schools that we were attending. And so I attributed those differences to what I might say cultural differences in the family rather to my own differences. Got around okay, maybe bumped and tumbled a little more than the average child, but again, not a big deal. As I grew up, I gradually weaned myself from the practice of print reading. And luckily, because reading had been so highly valued in the family, I was able to graduate high school and college with very little reading. And what I did was sit in the front of the classroom and try to concentrate. In college, I carried what I called a placebo notebook, which I realized sitting in the front of the class and concentrating kind of made the teachers feel awkward. So I brought a notebook and I would write in it occasionally just to make them feel good. A placebo in the sense that I never used it for rehearsal or review, but there might have been something to be said for the multimodal approach to writing down key information. Today, I'm standing here sort of reading my notes in Braille, and so I still prefer the notebook approach, but now I can actually read things back. Reached a point in my mid-20s where not only had I weaned away from print reading to the point of not doing it ever, but was finding that I had troubles moving around independently and really needed to make some life changes. I had somewhat believed that perhaps I was a special anomaly. Perhaps I was somebody who would be able to stand on the threshold of blindness, but never enter the door. I learned how to work within systems of American government, such as paying an eye doctor a yearly fee to sign a form that allowed me to take a driving test. And as long as I could take that driving test, which I assure you I picked very carefully what day and lighting conditions I went down there to do it on, and was able to pass it and get by. Now, should I have driven? Probably not. Luckily, nobody got hurt. But at this point of realizing that, you know, if I was having trouble navigating stairs and walking around familiar places, perhaps driving really was not a good idea. And realizing also that, as I had said, I would often pick conditions and decide what would be the best timing to do things, I realized one day that it had been over a year since I felt like conditions were appropriate for driving, and that every time I wanted to get into the automobile, I had to charge the battery and air the tires and so on. And I began realizing that, no, in fact, whether I liked it or not, I had crossed that threshold. People come to you in your life sometimes with the message when you need it the most. I had known a teacher at Wichita State who was a graduate student when I first met him as part of the student government, which I was also part of. And then he went on to be a math teacher there. I believe he teaches still at Cowley County Community College in Ark City. Anyhow, this fellow Leo Traverso was known to the math teachers as a competent blind person. So another math teacher heard that I was unsure of what to do with my life and had come to me and said, well, you need to call Leo. I don't want to bother Leo. I don't want to get into this with this gentleman. But I kind of glossed over that. And yeah, I'll talk to Leo, whatever. It's great. I'm doing fine. Well, so anyway, this other math teacher, Buddy Johns, who I believe is now deceased, but I'll never forget this gentleman, ratted me out. And a little while later, this all happened within the, you know, a one-day period, basically. I got a telephone call from Leo Traverso. And I, oh, great, I've been ratted out, and now the word is out on me, and there's going to be a lot of suspicion of my competence. That was mostly what I was afraid of. I did not want to appear to be different. Anyhow, Leo said, so what are you doing? What are you getting? You know, what are you doing with your life? I said, well, I understand there is a process called blindness rehabilitation, and I understand there's an agency in the state of Kansas that can pay for this rehabilitation. And in fact, that agency is called Vocational Rehabilitation. It's a federally funded program, and anybody who is legally blind has immediate access to that program, or as immediate as things happen with the state of Kansas, let's say. But you are immediately eligible by law. So Leo says, well, how have you got this lined up? I said, well, I called down there. I've got an appointment with the guy. He says, who's the guy? I told him. He said, okay, what I want you to do is hang up the phone with me. I want you to call back and cancel the appointment with that guy immediately. Then I want you to call back again, pretend to be a new person, and schedule an appointment with a woman named Donna Wood. I said, okay, all right, I'll do it. I followed Leo's advice. I got an appointment with a lady named Donna Wood. Now, at the moment, I didn't really remember meeting Donna previously, but in fact, she had called me several times about 10 years earlier because somebody else, a state agency or an eye doctor or the driver's license department or somebody, had ratted me out to her at that time. And what I remembered after I got to meet her a little bit, in fact, was that she had called and left these lovely messages on the telephone machine inviting me to come to her caning class. And in my mind, what she was referring to was working in a workshop probably run by the state. It sounded pretty Dickensian. So I basically called back and I said, ma'am, I have no interest in making furniture for the state, but thank you very much, and dodged that and never heard from her again and felt, okay, job well done. Okay. But so my second meeting, or the second occasion to be able to meet Donna Wood, she introduced me to the Skills of Blindness and also the National Federation of the Blind. The Federation believes that blind people can basically do what they want in life with proper tools, training, and opportunity. That's the bottom line. That's the most easy explanation. Under Donna's tutelage, I put on what are called the sleep shades. That's a fancy name for blindfold. Walked beside her. She used her long white cane. She explained to me that the the cane I had purchased for myself at a medical supply store when I figured out I needed to start learning these things was in fact for a child, and it came up about to my hip, and I didn't know any better. I was kind of fumbling around with the thing. She laughed and laughed. "Oh, Thomas, that's a child's cane. What you need is something that allows you to reach ahead and see what's in the world before you find it and bump your nose into it." Okay, that seemed reasonable. And she told me, "Well, although the state may give you this thing with a golf grip and comes up to about your waist, what you're going to find is that maybe the free tool is not the best one there is. So I want you to save up $25 and buy yourself a cane that comes up to about your nose, and you're going to find you're able to take long paces, can be able to stretch your legs, and you're going to like it a lot better." She was right. I participated with Donna in the cane training, braille training, and other what we call independence training. It's basically, you know, how do I know what temperature I'm setting the stove to? And, you know, a lot of these things are real simple. It turns out, say, for somebody like me, I really only need three bumps on the stove. I want to know where 250, 350, and 450 are. Because most stuff, if it says bake, is 350, and, you know, if you want to cook a pizza, you're going to crank it up more to the 450 range. I don't do a lot of cooking that requires precise temperatures, it turns out. But Donna was able to tell me all of these things and make it seem easy. And in that way, changed my life and helped me understand that, in fact, for the first time, I was really living as I had always been, and I was really coming to be the person I had always been, but had kept under wraps, but had had tried to avoid people knowing. As I came out as a blind person, so to speak, other adults that had been around most of my life, who were the more savvy ones, it turns out, I found out they always knew. They'd say, "You know, I remember when you and your little sister were kids, and you'd come looking for your father to tell him it was time to leave the party. And everybody who was wearing a pair of jeans, you would come up and pull on their jeans and say, 'Tom, Tom, Tom,' and they'd say, 'No, I'm not your dad.'" And that's how I got the job done. Didn't seem abnormal to me in the least, but eventually I would find the appropriate set of jeans and maybe gradually gain attention and demand to leave the party. I should ask, Katie, was that a cue already? Or just a clearing of throat?
Yes, about 10 minutes. We have about 10 minutes.
Okay, good, because I'm getting too far into my personal story, and I need to get back to the historical part. So in our American milieu, so to speak, freedom of association is extremely important. In the mid-19th century, no? Yes, I'm getting that right. In the mid-19th century, people became interested in, and in a growing way, in rights for all people, not just wealthy white male landowners, which from the beginning was really who had the right to vote, who had the right to hold property, who had the right to be what we consider today fully enfranchised citizens. Of course, there's the great Seneca Falls Convention, which began the women's rights movement. At that convention, I believe it was Sojourner Truth, delivered the famous speech, "Ain't I a Woman?", opening the then progressives' mind to the idea that perhaps black women also should be included in the struggle for equal rights for women. From that time forward, the American landscape has not been the same, and in my opinion has changed for the better. I've got a few interesting dates to put in, help put this into perspective for us. In 1880, the first self-associated group on a nationwide basis of disabled people was formed as the National Association of the Deaf. In 1909, let me make sure I'm getting this right, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, was formed. In 1935, we have the Congress of Industrial Organizations, later to merge with American Federation of Labor and become what we know today as AFL-CIO. Blind people as a group were somewhat behind this curve in self-organization, but in 1940, a group of seven state organizations gathered in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and formed the National Federation of the Blind. Since that time, we have been working, in, as our motto states, to provide security, equality, and opportunity for all blind Americans. At the beginning, security was the most important thing on people's minds. The Social Security system had come into existence merely 4 years earlier, and a big issue for blind folks was that some states had what were called blindness pensions, some did not, but amount of support and or whether it was available and what sort of regulations would make a person eligible for this kind of thing varied dramatically across the country. So a big issue was that since we had this new Social Security system, people thought that there should be a uniform coverage of eligibility and who gets what. Also, jobs and education were really big on the agenda. At that time, it is commonly reported that probably 90% or more, maybe as high as 99% of blind people were unemployed. And the vast majority of employed blind people were employed in really something that is very similar to those guild or craft groups of the Renaissance times. The primary difference in the 20th century being that these groups were run now by sighted bosses, and they had changed the name from a craft workshop to a workshop. The idea basically had come out of progressive movement of the late 19th century, and it was mostly driven by people not wanting to deal with people begging on the street. The image of the blind person at that time was somebody that played a fiddle or a guitar and had a tin cup and maybe was selling pencils, if they were lucky. If they weren't so lucky, they just plain begged. And to deal with that, these workshops were invented, which was not a terrible thing in all ways, although the idea that all blind people wanted to work in the workshop and would just be good at it was probably somewhat misguided. So we move forward. The issues of immediate bread on the table gave way to issues of enfranchisement and equal standing under the law. The first great leader of the National Federation of the Blind was a man named Jacobus Ten Broeck. And he was a doctor of the law and educated at University of Chicago, but could never find a job teaching law. Eventually did work and spent most of his career at University of California at Berkeley and taught communications. Dr. Ten Broeck understood both the beauty of the American system in that it allows the potential for change, but also understood the not-so-beautiful part about where blind people stood in that system. He wrote a paper called Disability and the Right to Live in the World, which greatly influenced the soon to become the disability movement. That particular paper was also referenced in the Board versus Brown of Education case, which we're all familiar with. So, as things move forward, the idea of equal standing really took, under the law, that is, became the number one priority of the National Federation of the Blind. And through the 50s and 60s, many fights and battles were won. Some of the changes in culture that came about was that the routine practice of taking children away from blind parents was stopped. Had I been born only 15 or 20 years earlier in a southern state, mandatory sterilization was the law, and that would have been encouraged very strongly to my parents at the time of birth. Happy to be a child of the 70s, let me tell you. Things move forward. Some of our battles resulted in legislation. Kansas and all 50 states have something called the White Cane Law, which guarantees access to highways and byways without what is called a presumption of negligence, which up until the passage of these laws, if a blind person happened to be run down or hurt themselves on public transit, they were automatically assumed to be negligent, and that was just that. That was it. Because if you were out in the world, you probably were negligent. You should have been with your assistant, so to speak. So again, by the late 60s, we had overcome that particular hurdle and moved forward. So I think I've heard my other cue. It's amazingly easy to ramble on for 20 minutes, it turns out. So let's talk about where we're at today. Things have come a long way, but still there is a lot of work to do. Misconceptions still abound, and depending on what part of the country you're in, the general cultural expectations may be higher or lower. We live in a part of the country, unfortunately, where the bar is set pretty low. The vast majority of blind people in Kansas still work in what are called sheltered workshops, many of them for less than minimum wage. We live in a part of the country where it is what the federal agency refers to as an extremely parsimonious state agency, which is a very nice way of saying they don't really like doing their job. And so rather than encourage people to really achieve the greatest they can achieve, they try to push for here's a cane, and, you know, there's Braille out there to be learned. See you later. Hope you can do well with that. And, again, that's why we have the Federation. As we meet blind people, we try to self-educate. We try to help share the skills and help share the idea that blindness is merely a characteristic and that some people are challenged with being over 7 feet tall, and they get to notice all the cobwebs and dirt and dust on top of people's refrigerators and things like that. And, you know, it's got its problems to live with. Other people have red hair, whatever it might be, or no hair. Whatever it might be, blindness is merely a characteristic, and that if you accept that and think of that of blindness as just being who you are, life becomes a lot easier. In 2010, Independence, Missouri, a young couple was confronted with a nurse when the new mother was learning to nurse her child. The child had had some choking. The nurse said, you know, I don't believe you're responsible parents, and on the basis of blindness, this child was removed from the parents. Now, again, this is not a routine practice in today's world, but it was very scary to all of us that the opinion of one nurse in one small town in Missouri was enough to have a child removed for 52 days before legal action was able to prevail. This flew through the state of Missouri system, and no one questioned these decisions. In fact, the state social services department in Missouri really went to the mat to try to uphold this decision. Now, of course, once it went to court, they lost. The good news is baby Michaela was returned. Excuse me. I still get choked up thinking about that. Back in the 1960s, there was a man who wanted to become a chiropractor in Iowa. He was denied access to a school called Palmer Chiropractic, which is a famous chiropractic institution. He sued, After a few years, he won, and he did become a chiropractor and went on to have a long practice, has been retired, and I believe is deceased now. 8 years ago, a young man named Aaron Cannon was also denied access to Palmer Chiropractic. Interestingly, just Friday, a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court came in that says they, in fact, were violating his civil rights and that no one is telling them how to create their curriculum, but whatever curriculum they do create, the law says they have to make that curriculum accessible. So after 8 years, Aaron will now attend Palmer Chiropractic. Now, why I mention these particular two incidents is I think they demonstrate that, unfortunately, although progress gets made, bad ideas don't necessarily go away. People often believe the world should resemble their own image, and often those people achieve positions of power and have to recognize that the world does not always resemble their image and that not everybody is like them. And to me, these two things underscore why we need to have the Federation as a continuing entity. Even though some of the details and some of the flavors and, let's say, the tools and technology change over time, we've still got to be there to continue our ongoing mission of education and cultural change. So, today, I want to ask you all to help us in that mission. And I'm going to wrap this up and make it brief because I know I'm getting close to time, if not over. Katie, would you gesture to where the table at the back of the room is?
I actually moved it out to the lobby.
Oh, it's in the lobby. Okay. That's why I was asking. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I can repeat that. So there is a table in the lobby space, and on that table are some sample letters, and if you're so encouraged, you can help us with one of our current fights. Back in 1938, a piece of legislation called the Labor Standards Act was passed, which in some ways was a wonderful thing, as that is for the first time allowed a federal agency to oversee disputes between labor groups and companies. At that time, however, disabled employees were left out, and there is actually was an exception put into that law which allows any employer to file for what is called a special wage certificate. It's called Section 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act. What special wages really mean are subminimum wages. In Wichita, Kansas, we have a workshop that specializes in blind people called Envision. At Envision, the low wage in their subminimum workshop is 21 cents an hour. The average wage is about a dollar. It may be as high as $1.40. There are a lot of reasons that are given for justifying this abhorrent and antiquated practice, but in my opinion, none of them are good ones. Mostly lack of imagination on the part of the bosses of the workshop, if you're going to get down to it. The Federation is sponsored a bill which we have both Republican and Democratic sponsorship for in the House of Representatives. That is H.R. number 831, the Fair Wages for Workers Act. Maybe it's the Fair Wages for Workers with Disabilities Act. I'm terrible at the jargon sometimes. But the important part is H.R. 831. Since we live in Kansas, you'll want to know that the Republican sponsor is a fellow named Greg Harper from Mississippi. Greg Harper has a cognitively disabled child, and when Goodwill Industries was one of the major offenders of users of this subminimum wage, came to him and made disparaging remarks about the cognitively disabled as a group, he decided he was going to get on board with us on this thing. So we have some letters, envelopes, so on, all ready to go. You can write a personal statement. You don't have to. If you would like to personally call, email, or write to your representative, who I believe is Tim Heelskamp in the big First District of Kansas here in Manhattan, please do, and encourage them, or him, or any other representatives you wish to contact to co-sponsor H.R. 831. So that's what I have for today. Thank you all. I may have overrun our question time, but if there are a couple questions, maybe we could take them. That's my favorite part, and I should have gone a little faster.
So please, I invite, if there are a few questions, Tom will stay here. Tom will stay right here.
All right, but you'll point out whoever it is. You're going to call people.
We've got a microphone coming out.
Okay, if microphone coming out is great. The way we do this in the Federation, we have what we call our Federation meeting style, and that is somebody says their last name or first name, and whoever's running the meeting keeps that list of names in mind, and then they can say when everybody wants to talk at once, which happens all the time, no, I have Paige, then Wood, then whoever, and then you call on each other. So who is first on the questions?
Hi, my name is Michaela Severs. And
hi, Michaela.
I was just interested to note that you didn't mention anything about like service dogs.
You know, service dogs are a fine thing. I have been a pet dog person most of my life, and so I may be too much of a softie for working dogs. So I don't often think of the service animal in my own practice, but I know people who do very well with their service dogs. A Federationist who was quite prominent once made the mistake of saying that service animals are a misguided attempt to provide a pair of eyes for somebody who really doesn't need them. And that has followed the Federation for a long time. So if you've heard any business that we're anti-service dog, it's certainly untrue. But they're great. It's all up to the individual as to what tools, you know, are best to get the job done for them.
I'm Ann March, and thank you so much for making us more aware of this, of your situation, the situation of blind people. I'm curious, does the ACLU do anything or has done anything for your group?
No, although, you know, we often cross over in terms of mission. I don't believe there's been any direct involvement with them in any of our cases. I think part of that basically comes down to that since the beginning of the Federation, there have been a lot of lawyers involved who were blind. And so we haven't had to go looking for outside legal assistance, if that helps answer that.
Jim Chantel.
Jim?
I have a question. I noticed that I'm holding my iPhone here up,
uh-huh,
which I use constantly,
uh-huh,
and I've found it's amazing what technology has done to change my life.
Oh, yeah.
I'm curious what technology has done to change the lives of blind people.
Well, technology is great. I used what is called the Slayton Stylus to make my Braille notes today. That was a tool invented by Louis Braille in the 19th century. Now, an interesting tidbit is that during Louis Braille's lifetime, Braille was actually not endorsed by the Wards of the Blind in France and, in fact, was declared illegal. And it was only after he died that it was accepted as a writing method for blind people. It was considered presumptuous at that time for blind people to want to read. Technology has made that better, of course, because now we can produce volumes of Braille through electronic means incredibly fast. And these Braille embossers sound fantastic. They chicka-chicka-chicka, and they punch out the Braille in a miraculous way. You mentioned the iPhone. I've left mine at Katie's house this morning because I forgot to pull it off the charger. But there is a system called VoiceOver that's built into all of the iDevices, courtesy of Apple. And so I enjoy the iPhone myself. I think it's a great tool. It has a built-in compass. That's a pretty neat use of technology for me. Weather, all kinds of great stuff. Let me say, however, that for 4 years of litigation, Apple maintained that this was an inherently visual device which could not be made to work in an auditory manner. We won another big case in California, and they settled, and 6 months later we got the VoiceOver. And you don't hear a lot about that because of a non-disclosure agreement with Apple. But thank you, Federation, for opening the iPhone to all of us. And so, Jim, that's probably not really answering your question, but I'm happy to talk to you later. Technology is great. However, I think in some ways technology does not ameliorate cultural misunderstanding or allow the most basic functions of life, that the, unless you look at the simple tools as being a form of technology, which they are.
I might, Mark Mayfield, I might add that an iPhone can make perfectly good seers into more or less blind people themselves.
Yes.
Hi, Betty Banner. Hi, Betty. I just might say that for several years when I was working, I had a person who rode to work with me every morning, and this person was indeed blind.
Uh-huh.
And he worked as a mental health counselor.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And technology was an important tool for doing his job.
Absolutely.
So it's out there.
Imagine you used a note taker or that kind of machine or screen reading.
I'm not sure all of what his tools were, uh-huh. and they were employer provided.
Excellent. Well, and thank you for recognizing that. You know, the one thing that was probably very difficult for that individual was driving to work. And along those lines, I didn't do a very good articulation on the technology issue. Besides the practice of driving and that kind of business, the thing that blind people really want the most probably is information access. And so where technology provides that information access, we find it to be very valuable. Is that okay? Okay. And certainly I'll entertain any other questions when we're done with the service.
And since we are just a few minutes behind in our schedule, I'd like to suggest that we close on a song in lieu of any closing words. And there is an insert in your order of service with the words to the song. And Tom, feel free to Tom will feel free to introduce the song as he wishes.
There are some words to go there. What? No words?
Tom, sorry. I should have been a little more clear. Please sing. Please sing the words
that
you find in your order
along.
Of service.
But I was going to say, too, part of why I chose this song is what we're talking about today is organizing for cultural change. A group, the early part of the 20th century, called the Industrial Workers of the World, rose up to allow people who had been disenfranchised or were not allowed to join the craft unions of that period. Unskilled workers had no ability to unionize, although the basic mechanisms were already there. They formed their own group, again, by taking advantage of the power of the right of freedom to associate. And although they were told they couldn't do it, they did it anyway. And they were told they couldn't speak about their group, they did it anyway. And the Federation history very much resembles the history of the Wobblies, in my opinion, except the Federation has never advocated for the overthrow of the capitalist system. Be it neither here nor there, back in 1910, the Wobblies were being told they could not organize and that they would not be allowed to march. And they had a lot of organizing songs, and a fellow named T-Bone Slim made up this song back then. This is what they were singing back in 1910. The Popular Wobbly is the kind of older title of this tune. See if I can make it happen here for you. They went wild, simply wild over me. I'll give you the way it sings first. They went wild, simply wild over me. Here we go. Let's do it again now. They went wild, simply wild over me. I'd never done them harm that I can see. Still on me they put a ban and they threw me in the can. They went wild, simply wild over me. And the cop, he went wild over me. He held his gun so everyone could see. Well, he was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the jailer went wild over me. When he locked me up and threw away the key,
It seems to be the rage to keep me in a cage. They went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge went wild over me. And I plainly saw we never could agree. So I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me. We'll have a little instrumental here. We'll keep it primitive, like wobbly style here for you. Will the roses grow wild over me when I've gone into the land that is to be? When my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Now, Utah Phillips added this part. God, he went wild over me. When I knelt beside the throne on bended knee, some angels heard me yell, and they shot me straight to hell. Well, they went wild, simply wild over me. All righty now. Thank you.